Prophecy Club. I have Stan Day on the phone with me today. This guy has developed a process to forecast earthquakes that is now being used by the U.S. Navy. He's a researcher. He's written many books. One of the most famous is The Cosmic Conspiracy. He has various patterns discussing Yellowstone, seven different computer languages he works with. He studies biblical Hebrew, and he is a prophecy student. Today, we're going to be talking about the Garden of Eden. So, Stan Dale, welcome to the Prophecy Club.
Thank you, Stan. SJ, shall we say?
Yes. You and I go back. Matter of fact, I was telling yesterday, I said, when Prophecy Club started in 1993, the primary thing that kept us going was offering his book, The Cosmic Conspiracy. And at the time, you were living in Australia, and we would have to order, it seemed like, two or three books of them every month. We go back a long way. So, again, we're welcoming you and glad to have you at the Prophecy Club.
Okay. Thank you. I do remember those days. You'd order a few boxes, and we'd wrap them all up and shoot them up to you. And
I understand that you have discovered where the Garden of Eden is. Tell us about it.
You know, I'm positive about this. Let me just preface the discussion this way. I started looking for the Garden of Eden back in 1988 and 89, and I published my findings up to that point in time in the Vindicator Scrolls. And at that time, I traced the Garden of Eden back up to Ethiopia in the Danakil Plains, but I couldn't find a hedged garden area just where the rivers seemed to all lead. Years passed, and last year, I was doing research for another lecture I was going to do for a prophecy conference, and it involved expanding Earth and, you know, some geology and stuff. So I had asked the Scripps Institute over in California to supply me with a brand new database of the whole planet, of all the hills and valleys and everything. You know, it's a topographical map that they created from a satellite network and extremely high resolution, and they hadn't even given it to Google Earth yet. I was 2 months ahead of them releasing it to Google Earth, and they said, here, try it out and see what you think. So when I did and plugged it into my Google Earth, I was able to see incredible things as far as old riverbeds along coastlines and up in hills and valleys and, you know, in countries. And it gave me so much more information to work with to find the Garden of Eden that I didn't know I was going to find a Garden of Eden. But anyway, I had all this stuff looking at the expanding Earth and how the Earth would have all fit together into one piece, you know, Pangaea. And as I was looking at that, I realized that where I thought the Garden of Eden was certainly was the confluence of three rivers, not the fourth one, but those all came from one source up the Great East African Rift. So on a lark, I thought, well, let's see where the water comes from to supply these rivers that I think were, you know, down the Danakil Plain that was the Garden of Eden. So I go back up the hill, miles and miles and miles up into Northeast Africa, where the Great East African Rift goes, and I found near Lake Victoria where those rivers all came from a plateau that's about, oh, roughly 9,000 to 10,000 feet high, and it's formed by seven volcanoes altogether. And an eighth volcano is still active that's connected to the edge of it, called the Mountain of God by the locals. And now I was excited. I thought, wow, this is where the Garden of Eden must have been, because the central crater, its walls are all intact. It's a collapsed volcano. It used to be about 19,000 feet high back in the dawn of mankind or whatever, but it had collapsed. And it had formed this huge 100-square-mile hedged-in area like a garden in the old Hebrew would be. A gan is a walled area in which you keep your livestock. I thought, wow. So I started researching now the Garden of Eden because I lost, you know, kind of track of where I was going with the collapsing Earth or expanding Earth type theories, and was now on the track of the Garden of Eden because it was just so much more information that I had before, and it was looking really good. And, okay, one thing led to another. I did find that there were some translational options, or optional word translations made by the King James translators that were good for the time they lived in. But when you look at things now, the alternate older values of those words in the ancient Hebrew were more apropos to what I just found. For instance, in English, they tell you that there was a river that watered the Garden of Eden, but it came out of the land of Eden, and it watered the Garden of Eden, and then from there it proceeded to become the headwaters of four great rivers that went out, you know, around various countries, and it describes the characteristics of those countries. Well, the verb that says, like for the river came out, the word is actually the river came up out of the land of Eden. And for it to do that, when you look at the word value, the adjectives, it's like it came up out of the land like the limbs of a tree spread out. And it was talking about a high-pressure water spring like a Yosemite at Old Faithful, except a huge one. And I found this. I looked into the geology there with the Scripps map and with Google Earth map. And right there on the top of the crater for the Garden of Eden called Ngoro Ngoro, up on the ledge, were several large areas which were once active fountains or springs. The area of one of them's ejection point was over 20 acres in area. It's huge. And I found another 21 after that all through that area up on the hill kind of north of the actual Garden of Eden where it watered down from there. I found another 21 of these that are still there today. And when you calculate the amounts of water that could come through those things, you are talking millions of gallons a second. I mean, bigger than four or five of the outflow of the Mississippi River per second. And then I looked and I saw where the rivers were so powerful, they'd come down out of the plateau where the garden is and chewed holes in the surface of the earth and make grooves. Then went to NASA and looked to see if they had any 3D stereo photographs of that area to see in 3D what it looked like. And when I got that picture, it was like megabytes of data. But when I got that and put on my red and green glasses, you know, for 3D, I could see that this tall mountain thing was a feature in all of Africa, high, and coming from it were these deep grooves cut into the earth heading for, you know, along the Great East African Rift, down into Ethiopia, cutting through to make the Red Sea, cutting over to where India used to connect to Northeast Africa. And I found those three. And then I came back and said, I need a fourth one. And I found the eastern side of the Garden of Eden plateau, where this one groove coming from the lip of the area where those springs were had come down and over toward Mount Kilimanjaro and around the north side of it and around and down to the coastline and then curved back around and into the sea. And another leg of it had come around at the same time on the south side of Kilimanjaro, forming a loop just like Genesis account said. And, you know, I put one thing together after another, and I found all four rivers. Most of them were 5,000 miles long or longer, and you would never find them today unless you put the Earth back together when all the continents touched, you know, and were in the land of Pangaea, that one single landmass. And that was before the flood. After the flood, during the time of Peleg, the Earth divided, as it says in Scripture. Whoever was writing the Genesis account was talking about the Garden of Eden's location, as though he were standing kind of west of it, I think. He was talking about mountain that lead to it, go where this the Mountain of Knowledge is. You find that in the Book of Jubilees as well. And this would have been after the flood, a 100 to 200 year period, somewhere in there, before everything started to split apart. He was talking about things that connected, you know, go across this ravine and that, and this is where the Garden of Eden is relative to a gorge and to the land grant of Ham. And when you put all those together, it had to be when the earth was massive as one chunk. I thought about this, and I thought, well, let's see in literature if we've got any other things that might talk about crater being the Garden of Eden or something like that. In the Middle Ages in Europe, the prevailing wisdom of the Christian religion was that the Garden of Eden survived the flood, but it did so because it was on a high place where the floodwaters wouldn't damage it much, and it would be on a craggy, mountainous area. And sure enough, I don't know how they determined this, but this is where I found what I think is the Garden of Eden. In fact, I'm positive of it. I looked for flora and fauna in the area and found that in that crater, which is 100 square miles, there's 25,000 different large animals and mammals there, 500 species of birds. It's lush and green. It does have a dry season, but it's really kind of a Garden of Eden to the animals of Africa. Huge buffalo, water buffalo migrations and stuff come through that area. I even found a fig tree, like the Bible says Eve wove skirts for them when they realized they were naked. And the fig tree is the quinine fig tree there in the garden, in the Ngoro Ngoro crater, and the leaves are like 2 inches wide by about 8 to 10 inches long, and they're known today those kind of leaves to be tough and leathery so you can sew them together without tearing them to make waist or loincloth or whatever else that she made for her and Adam.
That's fascinating. Keep going. I love it. Keep going.
Yeah. You know, the lions used to be kind of the dominant predator in the garden there in Garo. And when man was kicked out, that was before, you know, Cain and Abel were born. They were kicked out of the garden and placed over kind of east and north of there. The lions and other animals, you know, stayed. And it was like the lion kingdom didn't sin, but the man kingdom did. And so the king of the animals there, the lion, stayed all through time until now. And in the last few years, last probably decade, their numbers have been dwindling with diseases and ticks and things that are killing them off, so that there's only about, 65 or 70 of them left. So I thought, right, an age is coming to an end, even for the animals that were left there in the garden. Animals can come and go. It's a little bit of a hike to do it, but they can come in from the Serengeti Plain to the west, and there's a little pathway that the Maasai shepherds use to bring their cattle up and over the rim and down into the Ngorongoro crater to feed, and they do that every day, but they can't stay there. The law of Tanzania, where this is located, says no one can live permanently in this area. It's a protected, UNESCO-protected area. It's a conservancy now. You can come and feed your cattle, Maasai, but you got to take them home at night. You can't leave them there. So they are protecting this area as a national, well, actually a world treasure, and don't realize, not yet anyway, that they are protecting the original Garden of Eden from whence all mankind came through the line of Noah.
Wow.
And, you know, there's 500,000 people a year to go to visit it. It's so wonderful. Kings and queens, the Prime Minister of Japan, you know, Prince Charles and his boys. I mean, all kinds of people have gone there. And the movie Out of Africa, part of it was filmed there on the rim inside the Ngorongoro crater or the Garden of Eden. We're living in an incredible time when they are calling it like a Garden of Eden without realizing that you can prove it is the Garden of Eden. And when I saw that, I mean, I looked up this Ngorongoro crater. It's the first I'd ever heard of it by backtracking these rivers that all came to this plateau with these seven extinct volcanoes and, you know, one collapsed big one and this one mountain called, it's a volcano that attaches to it in the north. And it's called Old Doño Lingai in the Maasai words, which means mountain of God. It's been erupting since whenever it started. And back in the late 80s, it erupted then. But it's not like a normal volcano. It's called a natron volcano, only one of its kind in the world. It erupts slowly, you know, bubbles up the black magma or, you know, from the core of it. And it forms these big bubbly kind of silvery bubbles in the daylight that cool and crack and then break down and leave this white kind of powder. And that powder, 17% of it, get this, 17% of what comes out of that volcano today is what's in Alka-Seltzer.
Really?
It goes down, the waters and rains make all that stuff go down into Lake Natron, you know, obviously, to the northwest of there. And it's a salt lake. I mean, it's so filled with these various carbonates and salts that some birds have been fossilized. They're encased in this salty white material while they were sitting in the trees. Anyway, that mountain is known by all the local tribes going back 3,000 years at least as the Mountain of God. And that crater, the Ngorongoro, in the local language, that means big holes in the ground. And they say that that big hole, the Ngorongoro, well, it's a big hole, not holes, that Ngorongoro was where God created man and then left and went up into the sky and didn't come back. So they are telling us basically what's in the book of Genesis, even though it's been told by word of mouth for thousands of years and, you know, slightly altered, you know, as gossip markets or rumor markets go or legends or myths. But they do agree in the principal thing that God created man there, and obviously, then man was put outside of the garden to go and reproduce. Now, 5 miles, only 5 miles outside this crater of Ngorongoro is the museum where Mr. and Mrs. Leakey, you know, the Leakeys, found the oldest hominid bones to date in the planet. And they have the museum there at Old Dubai Gorge, 5 miles outside the rim of Ngorongoro, where they found the oldest human bones. And if you go 400 miles northeast of there, to along the path that man migrated down the East African Rift, you'll find the Omo Valley. Okay, what's that significant? Well, a number of biologists have been tracing DNA patterns for the mitochondrial Eve to see where we all came from, sampling tribes all over the world, and they found that they all come back to the Omo Valley, just down the road from where people were leaving the Ngorongoro in the Omo Valley. So even the mitochondrial Eve, the ancestral female gene, the DNA, came from within 400 miles of where the Garden of Eden is, you know, where we've located it, and it's along the migration path that you would have to follow along the rivers to get down into, you know, Ethiopia and then over into Saudi Arabia, you know, through Yemen. Now, the other day, I got an email from an Arab Muslim fellow saying, why don't you talk about the volcano at Aden in Yemen? Because the prophecies in the Quran and in the writings say that as the age ends, that there will be a evil Dajjal come, blah, 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 and there will be massive land movements and fire in Yemen area, which will force the faithful Muslims to move from their place of assembly. Well, I thought, well, okay, fine. I looked it up in the Hadith, and sure enough, it was there. And so I went over and I took my Google Earth, and I found the volcano called Aden, which is the way you pronounce the Garden of Eden in Hebrew and Arabic. It's Aden, A-D-E-N. And there's a town called Aden in the very middle of this volcanic crater, you know, extinct. But there are volcanoes just a few hundred miles around there in the Aden Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and also into the Arabian Sea. There are volcanoes that are being active. There's earthquakes in there that have become active. And there was one island formed a couple of years ago just off the coast of Yemen from volcanic activity. He said, something's happening there. Well, okay. So I read on, and I found that the Yemenis say that Aden, inside this volcano, is where the bodies of Cain and Abel are buried.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I thought, why? They couldn't go back to the Garden of Eden, but if they were buried inside of a volcanic crater like Eden was, which I've found, that's why they would have buried them there in memory of the crater that was the Garden of Eden. Do you see that?
Okay, so what, they have tombstones? I mean, how do they know that they're...
I don't know. I don't think they have that like a place they go worship, but they just say that by legend in the area, that's why they call it the town of Aden, the port of Aden, the Gulf of Aden, to remember where they came from.
So there's not just one or two reasons, but many, many, many reasons why all of the arrows point to... I mean, just like there's a city called Aden, that means Eden.
And it's right in the migration path down the Great East African Rift where those three big rivers came from.
I mean, fascinating.
If we accept the fact that this is Eden and those riverbeds that I've outlined are the four rivers and the earth was continents were all together, then you say, well, okay, if they were all together at that time, what countries did these major rivers, these four rivers, go around? One of them was India through Tanzania, and I think it probably included Madagascar, which is now a separated island. But it means that we have to revise our timeline for archaeology and geology. We have to say, if this occurred just after 2345 BC, in normal physics archaeology and geology, the breakup of Pangaea occurred 100 million years ago. That's wrong. And I can show you where the equation from the Big Bang, how the speed of light was at least 100 million times faster at the moment of the Big Bang, and then it's like a steep curve dropping straight down and then leveling out, and we're in the level out part where it's the speed of light is slowly slowing down, but not as fast as it did back in the beginning. And you correlate these back together again. Lambert Dolphin has done it. Barry Satterfield has done it. There's a number of people that have looked at it, and they can prove then or relate then by this formula to our modern dating system and to the eras in the radiological dating, because half-life of atoms decaying and stuff were all a function of the speed of light. And those would have occurred 100 million times faster in the beginning. So when they try to date a formation or a strata by the content of, say, radon or argon gas and the bubbles, all this kind of stuff, they are assuming that the decay rate was the same from the beginning of time till now, but it's not. It's a variable, and it's been decaying rapidly. So the Garden of Eden thing then forces us to look at this and say, well, okay, guys, we're going to have to come together on this. The Bible chronology may differ a few years here and there, but not hundreds of millions of years. And you guys are going to have to bring it into perspective and realize that the Earth is a planet of catastrophic events and not gradual sedimentary deposits. It's another thing that finding the Garden of Eden has done. Now, in the process of doing all this, putting it all back together and then letting it flow apart after the Peleg, after the time of the separating until the land divided, after that time, we come to the time of King Solomon. And it says that King Solomon had his mines at Ophir, Havilah. And so I thought, where was he going to get that gold? I mean, I looked at Madagascar. Oh, Madagascar is full of gold. It's gold dust that's washed down from the granite in the mountains there into a particular port. So I looked up King Solomon. I looked up in the Arab literature, looked up in the Christian literature and the Jewish literature. And he told where he was getting his gold, but in code. He said it's, you know, like Ophir. Well, Ophir in the Arabic and Hebrew idiom of the day could mean like the shape of a sultan's cap, pointy, you know, with a little ridge around it. Okay. And Ophir, it took 3 years to load up the ships and get them back from the gold they got there. So, and it was fine gold, really rich, fine gold. So I looked in Madagascar at the mining maps and found out that the French and the Chinese, all kinds of people at the moment, in there discovering this huge, huge gold field all through Madagascar, but particularly at the port there in the northeast corner. It's only one major port. And in the middle of that port is a cone-shaped projection like the cap of a sultan. The port forms kind of a ring around that. Today, they are paying, you know, like pittance wages to children who live in the area to go and sift the gold, you know, pan the gold out of the rivers. It is so plentiful even today that you can just pan it out. And that was where Ophir was. Then Havilah, there was a different one there in India. When all the continents were together, Madagascar, eastern Tanzania coastline, they touched. And Madagascar touched India in a place which is known today for the gold fields of India. So there was that whole little, like, band that went from Western India through Madagascar into Tanzania, and that was where all this gold was deposited in various forms. Karnataka is the region in India on the western coast called, you know, the gold fields of India. So that was part of where he went. And then I found out that Solomon, when he was talking about the location of his one distant field, was talking about the people of the book in Hebrew, and the religion in India, like Hinduism and various other forms of that, they would write down the Vedic scrolls on banana leaves, you know, and every 200 years they have to rewrite it because the banana leaf would decay. I forget the actual name of it, but it was in what I was researching. You see that the word that he used in Hebrew was the word that they used in India, and it's Parva. P-A-R-V-A is the ancient Hindu for books of their religion. And because they were written on these palm leaves and bound together with, you know, leather and stuff in a hole on the edge of it, he said that he had the gold of Parvaim. Well, I-M in Hebrew is plural masculine, and Parva is not a Hebrew word at all. It's an Indian word. And so you have the book, the books. So his gold came from Parvaim gold came from that part, which was over near the Indus River Valley, India. And then he had another source of gold in the Mediterranean up near, well, at the port of Morocco there, up in northwestern Africa there in the Mediterranean. The name for that gold field, you know, the ships from Tyre, the Phoenician ships, they came from west coast of like Israel and Palestine, and they went in the Mediterranean west toward the Straits of Gibraltar there, but they stopped off in this country to the west of there. It was called Tarshish, and it was known for the tar, which is like dope that makes you hallucinate and stuff like that. And that shisha in the area is what they used to burn the dope in, the opium and stuff, to, you know, to get high. And when you put all that together, then what Solomon's third mine there, the Tarshish mines, was the port of Morocco there. And that port was where, and in Spain across the water from that, they did this too, but Morocco is where he got it. He got apes and peacock feathers and stuff. He traded from Northwest Africa there in Morocco, from Algeria in there. It was known mainly because that was the dope head's port, the Tarshisha. And so you put all these together with the different languages that build these words that Solomon, you know, shared, and you see that these lands were where his gold mines were. And then, of course, I went from there on to another subject about King Solomon and his importance in the modern era, which is it's a heavy impact on prophecy and who the Antichrist
okay.
is.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to talk about King Solomon in the next broadcast. Stan, this is fascinating, brother. You folks out there, tune in for the next broadcast tomorrow. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your prayers. And thank you for your gifts of support. Now from the Prophecy Club, some exciting opportunities for you. Shocking, amazing heresy and blasphemy. Using over 100 video clips, you will see large, well-known ministers making shocking statements contrary to the Bible. Not just simple doctrinal errors, but open abomination, heresy, apostasy, even blasphemy. So bad, you'll have to see it to believe it. See some of your favorite, most popular pastors seduce you with lying signs and wonders. The biggest names teach a false Christ. Yes, it is true. Your mouth will fall open. God exposes the worst sins of the Bible in these DVDs called Error in the Church. Worse than the Old Testament. Nation-killing sins in America today. You won't be disappointed. You'll be furious, beyond angry. I thank God that Leslie showed me these shocking errors, and I would never have known it or believed it if I had not actually seen it. This will keep Prophecy Club and you from falling into error. Don't miss it. The fantastic offer of Error in the Church. Call today and give a $50 gift, and we will immediately ship you the first three DVDs, 13 topics, 11 DVDs. And we put it together in a fantastic new offer. Call today and give a $50 gift, and we will immediately ship you the first three DVDs. 30 days later, we'll charge your card for the second $50 gift, then send you the final eight DVDs totaling 11 DVDs. 30 days later, we'll charge the third $50 gift. 30 days later, the fourth and final $50 gift, making it easy for you to get this fantastic set of 11 DVDs. That is four monthly gifts of $50 each. Error in the Church, 13 topics, 11 DVDs, valued at $330. Get started today for a gift of just $50. If you already placed an order, call 785-266 and we'll explain your great deal. Call 785-266-1112 and ask them for the fantastic Error in the Church offer. $50 donation gets you three DVDs heading your way today. Error in the Church, 785-266-1112. Error in the Church, 785-266-1112. Call today. In 1980, an angel came to Dimitri Dudeman and told him that it is written in the Bible and that America will be defeated in 1 hour by Russia. I just made a brand new DVD covering all of the secular real-life proof that Russia really is preparing to do exactly that. Topics are Arise, Devour Much Flesh, Russia in Prophecy, Russia Now Rich and Strong, Russia's Numerous Military Expansions, Ukraine, and How It Is Making the Bear Angry. Russia is warning the U.S., but we're not listening. Russia is building their military, modernizing submarines, aircraft, missiles, and their army, while the U.S. is downsizing and filled with traitors and weaknesses. 2.5 hours, gift of $30. Go to prophecyclub.com or call 785-266-1112. That's The Russian Bear Rises at prophecyclub.com or 785-266-1112. Order today.